The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Yonkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is from the January 2022 Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled, What's the Best Blood Pressure Target for Older Adults? For people over 60, intensive blood pressure lowering may prevent more heart problems than standard therapy. Current guidelines from the nation's leading heart organizations say adults should aim for a blood pressure reading under 130 over 80. However, some doctors believe that target might be too aggressive for older people who may be more prone to side effects from blood pressure drugs like dizziness and falls. Now a new study confirms the effectiveness of intensive blood pressure reduction in people over 60. Not only is a lower target safe, it's also associated with better outcomes in older people, says Dr. Umberto Campia, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. The study in the September 30th, 2021 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine included more than 8,500 Chinese people aged 60 to 80 with high blood pressure. Half were randomly assigned to a standard treatment group with a target for systolic blood pressure, the first number in a blood pressure reading, of 130 to 150 millimeters of mercury. For the other half, the intensive treatment group, the systolic target was 110 to 130 millimeters of mercury. After a year, the average systolic blood pressure in the standard group was 135, compared with 127 in the intensive group. During a median follow-up of just over 3 years, researchers tracked the participants' rate of serious cardiovascular problems, including stroke, heart attack, heart failure, and atrial fibrillation. The incidence of these problems was 4.6% among those who received standard treatment, compared with 3.5% in those who received intensive treatment. Rates of adverse side effects, including dizziness, fainting, fractures, headaches, and cough, were similar in both groups, although the intensive treatment group experienced more episodes of abnormally low blood pressure, which is also called hypotension. The findings support those from an earlier trial done in the United States that also documented fewer heart-related problems when doctors aim for an even lower 120 millimeters of mercury systolic blood pressure target, says Dr. Campia. In fact, when researchers analyzed the results only from people ages 75 and older, the heart-related benefits were even more striking, and the rates of side effects were similar to those seen in people with a target of 140 millimeters of mercury. The incidence of high blood pressure clearly rises with age. In fact, the original term to describe high blood pressure seen in aging adults was essential hypertension, says Dr. Campia. At the time, the thinking was that high blood pressure was essential to deliver sufficient blood to the brain. With age, blood vessels become stiffer and less flexible. To reach the brain, circulating blood needs an extra push in the form of higher blood pressure. That's why some physicians have suggested that for people over 65, systolic blood pressure, the first number in the reading, can be as high as 150 millimeters of mercury. Increasingly, though, doctors are reconsidering their approach. We've learned that high systolic blood pressure in older adults is a major contributor to strokes, and to heart attacks, says Dr. Campia. The recent finding means older people should work with their physicians to bring their systolic blood pressure below 130 millimeters of mercury. People often expect that a single medication will get them to their blood pressure goal, but that's rarely feasible, says Dr. Campia. For example, someone with a systolic blood pressure of 150 millimeters of mercury almost always needs at least two medications. Even a full dose of a single drug will only lower the blood pressure an average of 5 to 10 points, he says. Using lower doses of two different blood pressure medications is more effective than maximizing the dose of a single drug. High blood pressure can result from several different mechanisms, so combining drugs that target different mechanisms typically works better, he adds. The combination approach is also less likely to cause side effects. Moreover, many combinations are available as single pills, which are as easy for patients to take as just one drug. We have a broad array of medications to control blood pressure, which means that doctors can usually find the right combination that's safe, effective, and free from side effects, says Dr. Campia. For a list of the different classes of blood pressure drugs and common examples, take a look at www.health.harvard.edu/heart-meds/blood pressure. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter, also from January, is called Living with Stable Angina. Many people with heart disease have predictable episodes of chest discomfort. Medications are almost always the best treatment for this chronic problem. Coronary artery disease, the most common type of heart disease, happens when the network of arteries that nourish the heart are narrowed by fatty and calcified plaque. This is a condition called atherosclerosis. The classic symptom, chest discomfort during physical exertion, is known as stable angina because it occurs in a predictable pattern. As many as two-thirds of people with coronary artery disease have stable angina, which usually resolves with rest within a few minutes. For decades, cardiologists debated the best way to treat this problem. Should you do a procedure to reopen the artery called angioplasty and stent, or should you try for optimal medical therapy? Optimal medical therapy means that you take medications to get your cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar levels under control and into a healthy range. The rationale for doing angioplasty on people with stable angina came from a long-held assumption that turned out to be wrong. Until about 30 years ago, the collective opinion was that atherosclerosis was an inexorable progressive disease that would eventually block off one or more of the heart's arteries, causing a heart attack. Doctors now recognize that most heart attacks occur in arteries that are only about 30 to 40% blocked, but which harbor so-called vulnerable plaque that ruptures without warning. The resulting blood clot blocks the blood flow, triggering a heart attack. This is why people have heart attacks out of the blue, without any prior angina as a warning sign. In fact, angina doesn't occur until a section of the coronary artery is blocked by at least 70%. The heart has an incredible ability to adapt by widening the smaller arteries downstream from the narrowed section of the artery. The impulse to open a severely narrowed artery with angioplasty and a stent is understandable. But several major trials confirm that for people with stable angina, stents don't offer any advantage over optimal medical therapy when it comes to preventing heart attack and death. Medications help treat and stabilize or even reverse atherosclerosis at all the heart's arteries, whereas stents address only specific spots. Drug therapy is less expensive and has fewer serious side effects. There's three classes of drugs that help relieve angina. Beta blockers, which slow down the heart, lowering its demand for blood. Calcium channel blockers. And nitrates, which relax and widen the blood vessels. But you can't necessarily expect improvement in a few days or even weeks. Repeat findings suggest that it can take 3 to 6 months for angina symptoms to abate with medication. But the evidence is overwhelmingly consistent that most people treated with optimal medical therapy do better over time than the people who are treated with angioplasty. Understandably, people with stable angina worry about having a fatal heart attack. But the risk is low, only about 0.4% per year in people who are careful to address all the risk factors. This means not smoking, eating a healthy diet with plenty of plant-based foods, getting regular exercise, and managing stress, in addition to taking the right combination and doses of medication. And the article goes on to mention, what does angina feel like? Derived from the Latin word angere, meaning to choke or strangle, angina is defined simply as chest pain. But the sensation is more often described as a discomfort rather than a pain. Some say it feels like a pressure or a heaviness, whereas others describe it as squeezing or burning, and say the sensation is in the center of the chest. Others describe the discomfort as occurring in the left arm, the shoulder, the neck, or the jaw. Stable angina occurs in response to exertion, like brisk walking or climbing stairs, and in some cases, emotional stress. It subsides within a few minutes with rest. Unstable angina, by contrast, occurs without warning and with only slight exertion, or even when you're just resting or sleeping. Angina that becomes more frequent, worsens, or lasts longer than usual is considered unstable and may signal a heart attack. If your symptoms of unstable angina don't get better within 10 minutes, you should be sure to call 911. And then, finally, from this issue of the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2022, we're going to go over some brief articles that are called Research We're Watching. The first is, FDA urges the food industry to cut back on salt. Last October, the FDA called for the food industry to try to voluntarily cut the amount of sodium in processed, packaged, and prepared foods. Those products provide about 70% of the sodium in the typical American diet, which includes an average of about 3,400 milligrams of sodium per day. The new targets seek to lower the average sodium intake by about 12% over the next 2.5 years, down to about 3,000 milligrams per day. That's still above the 2,300 milligrams recommended by federal dietary guidelines, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. Consuming too much salt can boost blood pressure and raises the risk of heart attack and stroke. In the meantime, try to eat more fresh, unprocessed food and cut back on the saltiest foods in your diet, or seek out lower sodium versions. The top sources of dietary sodium include breads, rolls, cold cuts, cured meats, pizza, poultry dishes like rotisserie chicken and chicken nuggets, soup, and sandwiches, including burgers. Another interesting article from Research We're Watching is entitled, Chemicals in Plastics and Personal Care Products are Linked to Heart Disease. Exposure to chemicals called phthalates found in commonly used plastics may be linked to a higher risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. Sometimes referred to as plasticizers, phthalates make vinyl plastics soft and flexible. They're used in industrial food processing, medical devices, and vinyl building products. And they're also found in such things as shampoos and lotions. A study was done on 5,303 adults whose median age was 57, who took part in a national health survey and provided urine samples. The urine could be used to measure their phthalate exposure. Researchers then tracked causes of death among the participants over the following decade. After controlling for possible confounding factors, they found that phthalate exposure was associated with a slightly higher risk of dying of any cause, but especially cardiovascular disease. Earlier research suggested that exposure to phthalates, which are known to interfere with the actions of human hormones, may be linked to obesity and diabetes risk. But the specific biologic connection to these potential health issues and heart disease remains unclear, and further study is needed. This report came from the Journal of Environmental Pollution, October 12, 2021. Finally, there's a brief report entitled, Low-Dose Aspirin is of Little Benefit for People Without a Prior Heart Attack. If you do not already have heart disease and are 60 or older, don't start taking low-dose aspirin to prevent a heart attack or stroke. If your age is in the range of 40 to 59, discuss with your doctor if you should consider an aspirin regimen. Those recommendations came from a draft statement issued by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force in October 2021 and stem from studies showing that for most people without heart disease, the risk from low-dose aspirin cancels out its potential heart-protecting power. Aspirin helps prevent blood clots that can cause a heart attack or stroke, but the drug can also cause serious bleeding in the gastrointestinal tract and brain. The recommendations aren't news to most cardiologists. In 2019, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology released similar guidelines, noting that aspirin's lack of net benefit for most people without known heart disease. But daily low-dose aspirin still makes sense for most people with heart disease. In the July 2021 Heart Letter feature, Advice About Daily Aspirin, more detailed information can be found. Now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter, and this is also the January 2022 issue. And the first thing I'm going to go over is called Ask the Doctor, and this is with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. The overall report is titled, How Does Regular Exercise Protect Against Mental Decline? And the question is it true that regular exercise protects not only against overweight, diabetes, and heart disease, but also against mental decline? How can exercise do all this? And Dr. Komaroff responds, We've had solid evidence for many decades that regular exercise offers protection against all those things. But how? That's the question. It's easy enough to see how burning calories with regular exercise would protect against weight gain. It's harder to understand how exercise might protect against diabetes, cardiovascular problems, and brain disease. In 2012, the Harvard Health Letter reported on the discovery at Harvard Medical School of a hormone called irisin. The hormone was discovered in mice, but then was found in humans as well. Irisin is produced during exercise by the muscles and might be produced by other organs, including the brain. Experiments showed that the molecule irisin turns white fat cells, which store fat, into brown fat cells, which burn fat, and also improves insulin resistance. Such changes reduce body weight and protect against both diabetes and heart disease. Could irisin also explain the beneficial effects of exercise on the brain? A recent research report from many of the same Harvard team published online August 20th, 2021, by the journal Nature Metabolism concludes that it may. When a gene essential to the production of irisin was knocked out in mice from birth, blood levels of irisin were very low, and brain cells were abnormal. In these mice, exercise did not improve brain function, as it did in mice with an intact gene. This indicated that irisin might indeed be responsible for the beneficial effects of exercise on the brain. To pursue this possibility further, the scientists used gene therapy to introduce new copies of this healthy gene into the mice that had knocked out gene. This led the mice to produce high levels of irisin when they exercised, and their cognitive performance improved. Then the scientists applied the gene therapy to boost levels of irisin in mice that had a disease like Alzheimer's disease. The cognitive performance of the mice improved, as did the brain changes characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. The studies identified one way that irisin may be protecting against Alzheimer's-like disease of the mouse by reducing brain inflammation. The lessons from study of mice do not always prove applicable to humans. Humans have the same irisin molecule as mice, and this offers hope that one day the discovery of irisin may prove to benefit human health. More broadly, this study indicates that many different health benefits of regular exercise may be caused, at least in part, by one or more hormones generated by the exercise. Now we're going to go on to the Harvard Health Letter, an article entitled, "The Heel Problem That Threatens Your Mobility." Cracked heels can cause pain, infection, and more. As we go older, our feet can develop patches of thick, dead skin called calluses. Calluses are especially common on the heels because they take a lot of pressure as we walk. That pressure, combined with older skin that's often thin and dry, makes us susceptible to a common, potentially debilitated condition called cracked heels. Calluses form as a result of friction. Sometimes it's caused by the way your foot strikes the floor, and sometimes it's due to loose shoes like sandals, which cause your feet to move around and rub against the shoe. With all that friction, the body protects itself by forming thicker skin on the heels, says Dr. Sarah Rose Sauld, a podiatric surgeon with Harvard-affiliated Mass General Brigham Integrated Health. When callous skin is very dry, it tends to crack. If you picture a piece of dry, brittle bread, you can imagine that it would crack open if you stepped on it, Rose Sauld says. Painful cracked calluses on the heels make it hard to walk and increase the risk for infection, since cracks open the door for bacteria to enter the body. If they get infected, cracked heels can turn into foot wounds, which can be hard to heal. And that's especially true for people with diabetes, or peripheral artery disease who have poor circulation in their legs and feet. Cracked heels can usually be treated at home if they're not infected, and if you're sure that the affected areas are calluses and not plantar warts or psoriasis, which would require different treatment. The best treatment is to put over-the-counter antibiotic ointment on the cracks to prevent infection, cover the area with a bandage that you change daily, wear socks and cushioned shoes, and adjust activities to take the pressure off your heels to promote healing. If there is any pain, redness, pus, or swelling, contact your doctor or podiatrist. It could indicate an infection, an urgent health matter for anyone, especially if you have diabetes or PAD. To treat the infection, your doctor will prescribe a topical or oral antibiotic. Then you have to return 2 weeks later to make sure you're healing correctly and the pain is going away. The doctor may also remove the callus with special tools, including scalpels and power sanders. And the article goes on to emphasize that in order to prevent cracked heels, you should keep your feet covered and always wear socks and cushioned shoes. You should also moisturize your feet regularly with thick moisturizers and emollients. You should cover your feet after moisturizing so you don't slip and fall. And calluses should be treated immediately by using a cream that contains the ingredient urea twice a day. Urea helps to break down the calluses. You should also use a pumice stone if the urea cream is not helping. The way to do that is to soak your feet and afterwards rub the calloused heels with the pumice stone to sand off the callus. And you should always check your feet for calluses regularly, particularly if you have diabetes or if you have peripheral artery disease, which can impair the circulation in your feet. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks a lot for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.